Okay, so today I am with Pat Walton. Pat has lived a long and varied life and spent quite a bit of time in Denbighshire. But Pat, you started out life in Liverpool.
Yes, I was born in Liverpool, although my parents lived in Rhyl. My great aunt had a nursing home there, and I was born there for convenience because the National Health Service hadn't come in, so it was free. And that was good. And off there I was born there. But brought back to Rhyl, and I was baptised at the Catholic Church on Wellington Road.
But even before getting to Rhyl, your family had travelled a bit because the origins were in Cornwall.
Yeah, the Pascoe family originated in Cornwall. And they were tinners. And of course miners, they moved around to various places, and so my family moved to the Isle of Man, to Laxey Glen, where the famous Laxey Wheel is now, and so they mined copper mainly there. And as with miners, probably in most places, they have other occupations. And so if a seam ran out or whatever, and they needed some other occupation, mine went to sea. So my father and my great-grandfather both ended up working for Canadian Pacific steamships. And they were both sanitary engineers, in other words, plumbers. And that's what they did on land when they left the sea. They became plumbers.
And your father was not the luckiest sailor in the Second World War, because I think he got torpedoed twice, didn't he?
Yeah, torpedoed twice off Ireland, and in a pretty bad way. And I think it affected him nowadays. Well, most of the people that have been in a war end up with some sort of trauma, I think, but it wasn't particularly recognised, I think, more in the First War. It was shell shock, but in the Second War, things that happened to people, I don't think they were so concerned about it. You know, you'd done your bit and that was it. And my cousin reckons that he was in a bad way, and he probably ended up having PTSD, and he did have a drink problem after the war.
But the family settled in Rhyl, which at the time, of course, was a thriving seaside resort.
Oh, yes. And, of course, my father then had a plumbing business, and he did a lot of hot and cold in every room because they converted these houses. And so they would put a wash basin in every room with and hot and cold water, nothing like an ensuite or a shower, just a wash basin to be able to wash. And there was a lot of that work around. And so my dad did that. And I think my uncle joined him. And my brother, who was 20 years older than me, I think he joined them doing that work.
So they were competitors of the famous real footballer, Don Spendlove.
I don't know.
Who was also a plumber in...
I don't
Rhyl
know.
At the time. Yeah.
But I know he used to buy his stuff from Vickers.
Yes.
That's where he was. That was the plumber's merchants. And sadly, my dad went bankrupt because he didn't sort of bother with keeping accounts, and he just did the work, took the money, and everybody went out celebrating.
But also your mum and dad and your grandmother ran guest houses?
Yeah, they all did. Yeah, both nanas. One nana was in Butterton Road. The other was in North Avenue, which is virtually opposite, up near the prom in the west end of Rhyl. And my auntie Lily was in Aquarium Street. So, and my mum and dad were in John Street. So they all took guests in. And I don't remember because my brother, obviously 20 years older, but my brother and his cousins, before I was born, they used to go meet the trains on us on the weekend when the people arrived. And Grandad built them like a go-kart. And they'd carry the luggage. Yes, well, yeah, where are you guys? At Butterton Road? Not a problem, sir. And off they'd take them. And so they'd do that for tips.
Ah, nice.
And then to come back the... the next week to take them back to the station with their luggage. So.
And the guest houses were run with very strict rules as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Breakfast in the morning.
Breakfast in the morning. Then they had to go out all day, not come back till tea time. And then we had a gong in the hall. And that summoned them for breakfast and dinner. And then during the time that they were out, obviously the rooms had been made up, meals would be prepared in advance and so forth.
And then, because of Dad's financial problems, you moved around a little bit from Rhyl and you went to various golf clubs where he was steward.
Yeah.
And then you ended up in Wrexham.
Mm. Yes, I ended up. We ended up in this awful pub at the top of Penybryn called the Albion, which was a what they would say is a big house, and it was, I'm not sure, two or three stories high. It seemed huge to me because I was only about five when we moved in there, and it was dark and dirty and horrible. It was, I just hated it, and I didn't have any friends. There, I felt terribly isolated as a little child, and we used to have sand out in the backyard. That was my only thing, and I'd have toys and books and comics to occupy me. But I really didn't like it. And then, of course, I got scarlet fever while I was there, which was really exciting because the ambulance came, and that was wonderful to be taken away in an ambulance. And then, of course, at the Mailer Hospital, you were put in isolation. Mm. So that was quite, it was all exciting. It was so much better than being in that awful pub.
Even the trip in the ambulance was exciting.
Oh, yeah, with the bell. There was a bell, not a siren. That was really good. I was thinking everybody would be hearing this bell. They'll know I'm in here. You know, like a kid would think. But although
the Albion was not your favourite place, the fact that it was three stories high did give you a fantastic vantage point.
Oh, yes.
For the big occasion in Wrexham.
Oh, yeah. I mean, first of all, I must say there were good bits, that we had a lot of Italians there in those days. And so on a Saturday night, they'd come along and play their piano, accordion and various instruments, and they'd be singing like Papa Piccolino and Funiculi Funicula, all these lovely songs. And that was really jolly. Mm. And everybody used to join in, community singing. They have to have karaoke now, but people just used to sing together in a pub. It was a lovely, lovely thing to hear all these little voices. Yeah.
The Italian community, were they in the steelworks or were they?
I don't know. Yeah. All I know is that the people that came to sing were Italian, and I thought it was terribly exotic. Yeah.
But you had some very important guests in 1953.
The new queen just been. I don't know. They say coronated now, don't they? We say crowned, but she'd been coronated, and with a handsome husband, Philip. They did a tour of the UK and they came to Wrexham. And in this awful pub, we were all leaning out of the windows because we were on like the first floor, and the car came directly under the window. And it was wonderful. You could actually lean over and see the Queen. There was no protection, but there was no roof on the car, no men riding shotgun, apparently. And when you look down Penybryn, the whole street was just a mass of Union flags. And it was wonderful. People were waving them and they were strung up everywhere. It was just really, really exciting, I can remember.
Not a Welsh flag in sight.
No, because it hadn't been introduced till 1959. I did check that out, actually, because I thought, that's odd. No green, no red. But no, it was a red, white and blue, a sea of red, white and blue. It was really, really exciting. And of course, the Queen was young and lovely and he was handsome, and it was just a magical time to be around, you know.
But like most things in your life, you weren't there that long at the Albion, and then you moved to another pub.
Yes, yes. They took a much smaller place, a very nice little pub in Coed Poeth, in Talwrn, which is the lower road in Coed Poeth. And that was a lovely, lovely little pub, yeah.
The Red Lion?
The Red Lion.
Yeah. But your introduction to school in Coed Poeth wasn't quite so welcoming.
Awful. I was sent to this Penygellu, and going back in those days, in the early mid-50s, the Welsh were very anti-English, you know, and so when I arrived at this school, I was hated immediately. And, you know, racism, well, I know all about that. Because I was English, I was kind of, you know, I got beaten up frequently just for being English. And so, it was just terrible. It is awful to be bullied. I mean, I make light of it, but, you know, when you come home bruised and you've been thrown on the floor and you've got gravel in your knees and you've been bleeding and your clothes are being ripped, it isn't funny. And in the end, my dad's just took me out of school. I think he complained once and nothing was done. And so he said, right, you're not going back there again. And then I think the truant officer came round to see why I wasn't in school. And my dad told him, she's not going back there. You know, we're just not having it. So I then got sent to this gorgeous, the School from Heaven, which was in Minera. It was C of E. It would be church in Wales now, but it was C of E school then, junior school. And it was the most magical school. I mean, I really should write it all down, you know, like Dylan Thomas, his childhood. I really should write what a magical place it was. And I know from looking on the internet, some of the websites dealing with Coed Poeth and Minera, people have got very, very special memories about the headmaster there who rejoiced in the name of Cadwallader Griffiths. And a prouder Welshman you couldn't have met. He was wonderful. And in fact, I don't know if you know Goldsmith's poem, I think, The Deserted Village.
I don't know.
Well, there's a line in it about the schoolmaster, and it goes, and still they gazed, and still the wonder grew that one small head could carry all he knew. Oh, I'm getting emotional. But he was so clever. He was a wonderful, wonderful teacher. And his purpose, it was that all the children would be able to read and write and be successful and enjoy school time. And so you'd go in the morning, and he'd put the record player would go on, and then he'd put a notice above the record player, and some music would be playing, and it would say, "Eine kleine Nachtmusik," you know, or it would be "Morning" from the Peer Gynt Suite by Grieg. So you'd identify pieces of music. You were being educated and enjoying lovely music. And then we'd have an assembly and we'd say prayers and sing hymns and what have you, and do our lessons. There was an infant school, I think the whole school was about 50 kids. And then I was in the juniors at this stage, and Mrs. John played the piano, so that when we were singing, Mrs. John had been rattling away on the old Joanna there. And we'd have a nature table. And I remember calling Mr. Griffiths one day, something was happening in the field, and I said, "Oh, sir, you've got to come. So he went and he said, "Oh, right, all the school had to go out then and look over the wall because a cow was calving. And we all had to watch the calf being born because that's an important thing for kiddies to see." So he was just wonderful. He'd go, I think he went to Oberammergau to the Passion Play. He used to go away every summer to Europe and come back with tales. So always something new to tell us. It was just a very, very interesting man.
So there was Mr. Cadwallader Griffiths. Were there any other teachers in the school?
Mrs. John. Hmm. They worked, and there were other teachers in the junior school, but I can't really remember them. And the bell was hanging outside the back entrance to the school, as it were, and with the rope, and the teacher used to pull the rope, and I think they did use a hand bell to call us in as well. And there were outside toilets. We had outside toilets. And it was cold. Oh, in the winter it was terribly cold to go there. And there used to be big blocks of Life Boy soap, so carbolic soap and cold water. There's nothing like it. It's a wonderful memory of that place. And he just wanted everybody to succeed. I got through my... Oh, and of course I used to go in from the Talon, and I used to walk through snowdrifts and whatnot, or sometimes go on Maggie Johnson's crate, which was an old bus that came. I think Maggie Johnson's bus company, I think they were from Southsea.
Yeah.
And they, you know, you'd sometimes get the bus to school. And if it was bad, they'd sometimes stop outside each child's house to pick you up. You know, it's like a taxi, really.
No closing the schools for a couple of flakes of snow in those
days. Oh, no, no. No, I mean, the milk would be frozen. And we'd huddle around, I guess it was a black stove, like a wood-burning stove. So you'd get warm, huddled round that, and the milk could be brought in. The birds would be at it to get the cream off the milk.
Packing it off, yeah.
Yeah, and that was lovely to have that ice-cold milk before it got snatched.
And of course, with the school, you enjoyed the school so much, you thrived and you passed your 11 plus.
Yeah.
And went to Grove Park.
Yeah.
But only for a short while.
Yeah. Because just going back briefly to Monera, we learnt to write with a stick pen and an inkwell.
Yeah.
You know, no blotting your copybook. So people always say to me, "Oh, you've got lovely writing." Well, I actually learnt to write in Monera, and then when I went to Grove Park, we learnt to write in italics.
Right.
You know, Grove Park was a wonderful school. Mm. Wonderful school.
But you weren't there long.
I was there for about a year, and then my father dropped dead suddenly, which was very sad. And my mum had to give up the pub, and it was very, very sad to leave the town.
Mm.
You know.
Of course, the pub in those days, the clientele were mainly from the steelworks and the mines.
Yeah. Mainly, they were like blast furnace men, and they were big, big drinkers, and they earned an awful lot of money. I can't quote figures because I don't know, but I know they were several times what an average man made, and they were driving things like a Ford Zephyr. One of them had a Ford Zephyr, and when they went out on a Saturday night, they'd get as many as they possibly could into that car and hit the pub. And of course, there was nothing to hit on the way back because there were no other cars. So I don't think it was an issue in those days. But they'd come in and, they'd have a tab, even for all the money that they had. Mm. They'd have a tab in the pub and they'd pay that off when they got paid on a Friday night or whatever it was. And then they'd run up a bill through the week, big drinkers.
Mm.
I think some were miners from, I think, Gresford and places like that, Clyde, but mainly the Brumbo Steelworks.
Yeah. So after Dad's death, you moved to Harrogate.
Mm. But I told you about Herbie, didn't I? The little pensioner up the road that used to come in.
You did mention it to me. Could just tell me about it again.
Yeah, he was a lovely chap. I think because I was an only child in an adult world for the most part, and he must have been in the First World War And he was just a little old fella. And I used to go in and sit by him and talk to him. If he, you know, when it was quiet, he'd maybe be the only person in our lunchtime or something. And I used to go and talk to him. And I've no idea how old he must have been. He might have been 70 or something. I don't really know. Mm. But he was an old man in those days. And he asked my mum permission. Could he take me home and make me a cup of tea, you know, in his house? And my mum said, yes, no problem. Can you imagine anybody doing that today?
Yeah.
I mean, you just wouldn't think of it, would you? But he was almost like a proxy granddad, as far as I was concerned. And so when we'd go to his house, which wasn't that often, you know, like once every few weeks or whatever, and we'd go in and he had a range, just a little terrace house he lived in. It had a little range with the where the kettle hung over the fire and little ovens either side of that. And so we'd go in and light the fire, and I it was already made up, and I used to light it with a spill to get the fire going, and then the tea would be made. And once the fire was going, I got to toast the bread, which was fresh from the local shop. And then we'd do that, and he'd get butter in. And so we'd just have bread, toast and butter, no jam or anything, just toast and lovely butter, and a cup of tea. And anyway, before too long, my mum said to me, you won't be seeing Herbie again. And I said, oh, why is that? And she said, oh, he's died. And it was the first time I'd ever heard really about death.
Yeah.
Which was, I mean, it was such a shock that people actually died. I mean, it was a concept that was foreign. And his sister came round and said, you can have anything from the house. So I got, because he'd been in the First World War, there was a shell case that he used to keep his spills by the fire. So I have that, and it's over there.
Oh, yes.
In the
yeah.
corner. That's yeah. Herbie's spills.
Yeah.
Bless him. And we used to sing. We used to, they're the memories I have as a child of singing, you know, the Italian singing. And he sang Mademoiselle from Armentières, Parlez-vous, and all the First World War songs, yeah.
Yeah.
So, that was a very sad loss when he went, yeah.
And then, as I say, you went to Harrogate.
Oh, yes, Harrogate.
Very posh. Yeah.
Lovely.
But eventually you came almost full circle and came back to Rhyl.
Yeah, in a circuit. Yeah, eventually came back.
So you've been back.
Well, came back, sort of the re-entry into Cymru was in Llanferis.
Near
Mold.
Yes.
And that was nice. I lived virtually at the foot of Mold Famau, and that was nice. I used to be able to stay. I was self-employed at this stage.
Doing
I worked in broadcast television.
Right.
Writing questions for quiz shows.
Right.
And so I could work anywhere.
Right.
And so I was there, and my friend, her husband was a vet, and he worked for the ministry, and he'd set off at 6 a.m. So we used to take all our dogs up Mold Famau weekdays. We'd be up there 6 o'clock, back about 9 o'clock.
Right.
Should be as fit as a flea, but I'm not.
So I'm intrigued now. Which shows did you set questions for?
Lots of daytime ones. I mean, like 8 years I did on one called Crosswits with Tom O'Connor, which was a crossword one. And Runway, that was, I'm just trying to think, that was Richard Maylis in the early days. And then later on, shows like, do you know, isn't it awful? I can't remember the names of some of them. I did one in Jeopardy, that was Bob Monkhouse, that was in Central Television. Mm-hmm. I did Millionaire, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, but for Ireland, not for the UK.
Oh, right.
And okay. Gay Byrne presented the Irish version. So I used to just send my stuff down the line, you know. But I also used to work, sometimes I'd actually go and stay in a place like Manchester if I was doing BBC shows, and actually work in the studio. So I'd be dealing with the questions with the presenter, going through them and what have we. Yeah. So that was interesting.
Yeah.
Because when you set a question for a quiz show, you have to give a minimum of two sources, separate sources, and then it goes to be verified.
Mm-hmm.
So that the occasional things where it does go wrong, it's a sheer fluke because it will have been well verified, you know.
Mm.
Well, I don't know about today, but I did that for about 17 years.
You'd have been in much demand today with all the quiz shows on the television.
I don't know now. I guess, you know, probably a lot of the questions are in databases now. I don't know how many people are involved anymore. I used to have like 9 bookcases of reference books at home. But as time went on, you could access info online. You know, but so like everything else, it just changes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So that allowed me, because I could work anywhere, I just decided to go and live in Cornwall.
Right.
And then I got fed up because it's quite strange. Cornwall is, well, they're virtually the same tribe as the Welsh.
Yeah,
Celts. But they're actually the same tribe, I think, you know, not just Celts, but they're actually linked. And the Tamar Bridge is the boundary there. And they regard the people from England as being from a foreign country, pretty much like the Welsh do.
Mm.
You know, it's quite strange, really, to be back. So it's almost like living in Wales.
Yeah.
And then, of course, all the people from England came to build their portfolios because they wanted property. And the price of property shot up. And pretty much like the Welsh, they sold their properties to these incomers and then realised that their kids had nowhere to live.
Yeah.
So they're pretty much in the same boat. And, of course, they've got their own flag, St. Piran's flag, and they have the Gorsedd and, you know, all very similar customs and everything, and their own language, which has been allowed to die, which they're trying to revive. But until they got their own parliament, there's no way it's going to be like Wales.
Mm.
But so it's very much like... But when everybody came in, these holidaymakers buying all the property as second homes, number one, they killed Cornwall because they made it look like Surrey-on-Sea. They put 6-foot fences between cottages and things. So it didn't look welcoming. And people were all on their own little patches. So they'd lost the magic of Cornwall. And then in the winter time, it was awful. It was like a ghost town, absolutely dead, because they were all holiday homes. And so I thought, oh, no, I don't think so. And so I moved back then.
Came to Llanberis, and then came to Rhyl from Llanberis?
No, that was earlier. I went from Llanberis to Cornwall.
Ah, right.
And then I came back to Prestatyn.
Right.
And on a new... build these awful Anwyl homes made of cardboard. And what I discovered when I bought this house was that Birmingham Council owned about a load of them, and they were sending all their Asbo people to live there.
Lovely.
And the postmaster told me there were 3 paedophiles living on that estate as well. And so it all new houses, and it was just awful. I mean, the things that went on. So I decided to move, and so here I am in Rhyl, in a nice part of Rhyl.
Yeah.
Near lovely fields and everything, all facilities.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.